Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Volume 63, number 1, the fall 2023 issue, It's Revolutionary, Prelude to War. Last time we read an article about the Edenton Resolves, and this is a sidebar article of that same topic, How Do We Know? By Sally Causey Bloom, who is an educator at the North Carolina Museum of History. When reading about the women of the Edenton area who signed the resolves, did you notice that it is not clear who actually drafted the document? Nor is there any record that the original document still exists. So how do we know about this event? Through primary sources, thoughtful reflection, and tradition. Let's start with primary sources. The first is the Virginia Gazette of November 3, 1774. It reprints, as far as we know, the resolves without any explanation or context. On January 16, 1775, the Morning Chronicle and London Advertiser also printed the resolves and an extract of a letter from North Carolina, author unknown, that provides additional information. Look closely at the text of the resolves. Here is what was published in the Morning Chronicle and London Advertiser. Extract of a letter from North Carolina, October 27th. The provincial deputies of North Carolina, having resolved not to drink any more tea, nor wear any more British cloth, etc., many ladies of this province have determined to give a memorable proof of their patriotism and have accordingly entered into the following honorable and spirited association. I send it to you to show your fair countrywoman how zealously and faithfully American ladies follow the laudable example of their husbands, and what opposition your matchless ministers may expect to receive from a people thus firmly united against them. Edenton, North Carolina, October 25th. As we cannot be indifferent on any occasion that appears nearly to affect the peace and happiness of our country, and as it has been thought necessary for the public good to enter into several particular resolves by a meeting of members deputed from one whole province, it is a duty which we owe not only to our near and dear connections who have concurred in them, but to ourselves who are essentially interested in their welfare, to do everything as far as lies in our power, to testify our sincere adherence to the fame. And we do therefore accordingly subscribe this paper as a witness of our fixed intention and solemn determination to do so. And it is signed with the following names: Abigail Charlton, Mary Blunt, F. Johnstone, Elizabeth Creasy, Margaret Cathcart, Elizabeth Patterson, Anne Johnstone, Jane Wellwood, Margaret Pearson, Mary Woolard, Penelope Dawson, Sarah Beasley, Jean Blair, Susanna Vale, Grace Clayton, Elizabeth Vale, Frances Hall, Elizabeth Vale, Mary Jones, Mary Creasy, Anne Hall, Mary Creasy, Rebecca Bonfield, Ruth Benbury, Sarah Littlejohn, Sarah Howcutt, Penelope Barker, Sarah Hoskins, Elizabeth P. Ormond, Mary Littledley, M. Payne, Sarah Valentine, Elizabeth Johnston, Elizabeth Cricket, Mary Bonner, Elizabeth Green, Lydia Bonner, Mary Ramsey, Sarah Howe, Anne Hornyblow, Lydia Bennett, Mary Hunter, Marion Wells, Tricia Cunningham, Anne Anderson, Elizabeth Roberts, Sarah Matthews, Elizabeth Roberts, Anne Houghton, Elizabeth Roberts, and Elizabeth Beasley. So when you look closely at the text of the resolves, you will see there is not a single mention of tea. The letter, however, shares that the signers of the resolves supported North Carolina's patriot leaders following their laudable example of not drinking tea. A few weeks later, on January 31, 1775, Arthur Iredell in London read this account and wrote to his brother James, who worked for the British government while living in Needington. Arthur asked his brother, "Pray, are you become patriot? I see by the newspapers the Edenton ladies have signalized themselves by their protest against tea drinking. The name of Johnston I see among others. Are any of my sister's relations patriotic heroines?" The sister Arthur references is James Iredell's wife, Hannah Johnston Iredell. She did not sign the resolves, although two of her sisters and one of her sisters-in-law did. James did become a patriot, by the way. Of course, there is the unflattering political cartoon of the event by Philip Daw, published in London on March 1775. The print shows a woman ignoring her child, another in an unsuitable embrace, and women talking manly by taking political action. Research exists for many of the signers, including information about Penelope Barker, born 1728, died 1796. Barker was born in Edenton, and by the time she was 27, possessed a sizable estate, including enslaved persons. Barker's husband, Thomas, became stranded in London for several years because of the Revolution and the British blockade of American ports. Penelope managed their estate and plantations on her own. These facts we know from primary sources. With the drive toward independence growing, Barker had to make careful consideration of where she, and by her extension her family, and their future loyalties would rest. Her decision to openly express opposition to Parliament's 1773 tax on tea made clear her choice. Barker had social, family, and economic ties with many women in the area. She is the woman most likely, according to tradition, meaning how the history has been shared over time, to have led them in writing and signing the resolves. It is possible that other sources will come to light as research continues on the Edenton resolves and the women who made them. There is a photograph also of a letter with and a portrait with the following caption: Hannah Johnston Iredell was the sister that Arthur Iredell referred to in his letter to James Iredell dated January 31, 1775. She chose not to sign the resolves. Painting of Hannah, circa 1820s, from the North Carolina Department of Natural and Cultural Resources, collection of historic Edenton State Historic Site. The letter is courtesy of the State Archives of North Carolina. The next article is The Road to Moore's Creek Bridge by Michael Cecere, C-E-C-E-R-E, who is a retired history teacher who lives in Williamsburg, Virginia. He taught high school and college-level American history for 30 years in Virginia. The author of 20 books and numerous articles on the Revolutionary War, he continues to research, write, and reenact the Revolution in retirement. The residents of New Bern, North Carolina's capital until 1792, were alarmed at the news that arrived by an express rider on May 6, 1775. British troops had fired upon Massachusetts militia at Lexington and Concord. The American colonists' long dispute with Great Britain had finally erupted into bloodshed in New England. North Carolina's royal governor, Josiah Martin, was concerned about the impact of the news. He reported to British leaders in London that many inhabitants of eastern North Carolina were infected with the same ill spirit that prevails in the other colonies. He added, however, that he could raise thousands of loyalists to defend royal authority from the interior countries, the interior counties of this province, where the people are in general well affected to royal government. Unfortunately for Governor Martin, Tryon Palace, the residence of the royal governor and his family, was in eastern North Carolina. He was thus surrounded by rebellious colonists, also known as Whigs, who viewed the royal governor with suspicion. Their distrust of the governor only grew when he had the cannon at Tryon Palace dismounted, claiming the wooden carriages were rotten and unsafe. Most did not believe his explanation, and tension between the governor and inhabitants grew. Martin was concerned that he and his family might soon be seized or harmed, so on May 29th he sent his family to New York by ship. He then traveled to Fort Johnston, today's city of Southport, near the mouth of the Cape Fear River, about 25 miles downriver from Wilmington. Here, the fort and the small British warship HMS Cruiser, 8 guns and 60 crew, offered some protection. Governor Martin requested 10,000 muskets, several cannon, and ammunition from General Gage in Boston, but Thomas Gage had his hands full defending Boston from an army of New England militia. Although no blood had yet been shed in North Carolina, Governor Martin informed Lord Dartmouth in London that reason and argument can never restore the just power and authority of government in America. The people now freely talk of hostility toward Britain in the language of aliens and avowed enemies. Martin added that the rod of correction cannot be longer spared. He assured Lord Dartmouth that if properly supplied, he could raise a Tory or Loyalist army to crush the rebels of North Carolina. In mid-July, Governor Martin fled Fort Johnston for the safety of the HMS Cruiser, anchored offshore in the Cape Fear River. North Carolina militia burned the fort, and a long standoff ensued for the rest of 1775. Martin sent several more letters to London pleading for British troops. His pleas for assistance were finally answered in January 1776. A British warship arrived with news that a large British force under General Henry Clinton was sailing for North Carolina to join with the Tory Loyalist troops that Martin claimed were waiting to rise in the colony's interior. Governor Martin issued a proclamation on January 10th that instructed all loyal subjects to rally to the king's standard and crush the traitorous rebellion that had gone on for too long. In other words, it was time for North Carolinians to fight for the king. On February 15th, Governor Josiah Martin learned that British troops were sailing to help him regain royal control of North Carolina. He instructed Tory leaders in the colony who had been lying low for months to gather at Cross Creek, which is today's Fayetteville. From there, they would continue along the Cape Fear River toward the coast to meet the British troops. He chose Donald MacDonald, a British officer who had come to North Carolina the previous summer under the pretense of being retired, to command the Tory forces. MacDonald was given the rank of Brigadier General. By mid-February, approximately 1,400 Tories gathered at Cross Creek, but nearly two-thirds of them lacked muskets. Most of North Carolina's Whig or Patriot forces had firearms, but their supply of gunpowder and lead was low. Colonel James Moore commanded his force of 1,100 militia and tried to block the Tories from marching to the coast. His efforts led to the bloody clash in the pre-dawn hours of February 27, 1776, at Moore's Creek Bridge. Here are the captions of the photographs accompanying this article. These young men wear reproduction colonial clothing as they participate as reenactors at Moore's Creek National Battlefield. They are about the age of many young men who fought in the real battle in 1776. This map of Cross Creek from 1770 shows how the Cape Fear River winds its way through the region. Did Governor Martin know he would be the last royal governor of North Carolina when he called for support against the revolutionaries? Next article is Powder Keg of Independence by Jason C. Howell, who was born in Washington, Georgia, and found a love for history at a young age as he played on Kettle Creek Battleground. Howell joined the United States Navy in 2002 and was honorably discharged in 2006. He then got a bachelor's degree in history in 2009 from UNC Wilmington. In 2016, Jason obtained his master's in U.S. military history. Jason is a park ranger at Moore's Creek National Battlefield. Some events in history make our ears perk up, our hearts pound with anticipation, and our thirst for knowledge slip into overdrive. One date that is forgotten to the American public, yet may be more important than July 4, 1776 itself, occurred on February 27, 1776. On that cold day, cannons roared over a small creek just above Wilmington in a battle with great consequence. It was one of the first decisive Patriot victories of the American Revolution, the Battle of Moore's Creek Bridge. North Carolinians were encouraged by this result. They passed resolves instructing their delegates at the Second Continental Congress, the gathering of colonial representatives in Philadelphia, to vote in favor of independence from Great Britain, making it the first colony to do so. Patriots were upset over what they felt were unfair taxes by Parliament and King George III of Great Britain. Throughout the colonies, these taxes spurred protests that pushed the colonists toward independence. If the protests in other colonies were the fuse of independence in America, North Carolina was the powder keg that blew the doors wide open, with some help from old Mother Covington and her daughter, names given to the cannon used by Patriots at the Battle of Moore's Creek Bridge. A short 3-minute battle saw the last use of a broadsword charge by Scottish Highlanders. It ended with a decisive Patriot victory with immediate implications for revolutionaries. The victory at Moore's Creek demonstrated the strength of Patriots in the area and hindered Loyalist support. When the British naval forces finally arrived in May 1776, they were beaten back by other Patriot forces at Sullivan's Island near Charleston, South Carolina. That ended British plans to squash the rebellion through the southern colonies. It would be years before British forces returned to the region. Today, Moore's Creek National Battlefield protects the site of the first decisive Patriot victories of the American Revolution. The site is located in Pender County, about 20 miles north of Wilmington, and it offers space for both reflection and activity. At the 87-acre park, visitors can walk through history and nature trails, explore monuments, and engage in living history demonstrations. The photograph accompanying this article has a caption, "A park ranger greets some of the reenactors at the 243rd anniversary of Moore's Creek Bridge at the Moore's Creek National Battlefield in 2019. The next article is "The Battle of Moore's Creek Bridge" by Michael Ciceri. The 1,100 Patriot troops who engaged the Tories, or Loyalists, at Moore's Creek Bridge on February 27, 1776, were under the command of Colonels Richard Caswell, Alexander Lillington, and John Ashe. They arrived at the bridge the day before the clash and dug in. Colonel Lillington and his 150 men were encamped behind hastily built earthworks on the east side of the creek and bridge, which was partially dismantled by the removal of planks. When Colonel Caswell arrived with 800 men, he initially encamped on the west side of the creek, but in the evening he changed his mind and joined Colonel Lillington on the east side of the creek. It was a wise decision. Moore's Creek was a very effective obstacle and could have become a trap if the Patriots had to retreat. The creek was approximately 50 feet wide at the site of the dismantled bridge, with approximately 5 feet of water covering a slick, muddy bottom. Swampy ground northwest of the creek funneled travelers toward the bridge, which the Tories would have to use to get across Moore's Creek. General Donald MacDonald commanded the Tory forces. He was a British officer who had come to North Carolina the previous summer under the pretense of being retired. MacDonald led his Tory army toward Moore's Creek Bridge on February 26th, encamping about 6 miles northwest of it. He sent a messenger to the rebel camp to demand their surrender, knowing full well that they would not. The real purpose of the messenger was to observe the rebel situation and report back to MacDonald. Colonel Caswell had not yet moved his troops across the creek when the messenger arrived, so General MacDonald was informed that the rebels were deployed on the same side of the creek as the Tories, with the bridge and the creek to their back. The news was too good to be true, and of course it was. The Tories prepared to attack. Colonel Caswell moved his troops across the creek and waited behind earthworks. Earthworks are an embankment or other construction made of earth, especially one used as a field fortification, on the east bank of Moore's Creek, waiting for the Tories to arrive. General MacDonald was too ill to participate in the attack, so command of the Tory troops fell to Captain Donald MacLeod. 800 Tories, many armed with just a broadsword, which is a large, heavy sword with a broad, double-edged blade used for cutting rather than thrusting. They began their march to the bridge at 1 a.m. They reached the outskirts of Caswell's abandoned camp an hour before dawn and separated into two wings to attack. General MacLeod led the right wing of the Tory force into the abandoned Whig camp and halted, disappointed that the Whigs had withdrawn. The Tories in the left wing continued on toward the dismantled bridge and ran into Patriot sentries. In an account partly written by British General Howe, it was recalled that Mr. McLean, with a party of about 40 men, came accidentally to the bridge, he being a stranger and it was still being dark. He was challenged by the enemy's sentinels, who shouted, "Who goes there?" McLean answered that he was a friend. The sentinels asked, "To whom?" McLean replied, "To the king." Upon making this reply, the sentinels squatted down upon their faces to the ground. Mr. McLean, uncertain but that they might be some of our own people that had crossed the bridge, challenged them in Gaelic, the native language of the Scots, to which they made no answer. Upon which he fired his own piece and ordered his party to fire. Upon the sound of gunfire, Captain McLeod rushed forward with the right wing and immediately ordered an advance on the dismantled bridge. Three cheers rang out from the Tories, and drums and bagpipes started up, encouraging the troops forward. The Tory account noted that the word of railament was King George and broadswords. Word of railament is a word, phrase, or sound shouted as a rallying cry by a group of people as a call to action. It's a battle cry used by soldiers. A picked detachment of Tories armed with only broadswords was sent forward and carefully made their way in the dark onto the beams of the bridge, which were coated with soap and tallow by the Patriots to make them slick. As the troops advanced on the other side, they marched forward, believing they had the rebels on the run. They were met, instead, by a devastating blast of musket and cannon fire. Captain McLeod had joined the lead element across the bridge and was pummeled by the Patriot fire, which was point-blank range. The carnage was shocking and described by Colonel James Moore, who arrived a few hours after the battle. The Tory army, with Captain McLeod at their head, made their attack on Colonel Caswell and Colonel Lillington in the most furious manner and advanced within 30 paces of our breastwork and artillery, where they met a very proper reception. Captain McLeod and Captain Campbell fell within a few paces of their breastwork, the former of whom received upwards of 20 bullets through his body, and in very few minutes the whole army was put to flight. The battle lasted just 3 minutes and ended in a complete rout, which is a disastrous defeat of the Tories. Shocked by the heavy gunfire of the rebels and the loss of their officers, the Tory force dissolved in panic. Many fled into the swampy ground northwest of the creek, desperate to return to their camp 6 miles away. General MacDonald realized it was impossible to rally his demoralized troop, but he hoped to get them back to the interior of the colony where they would be safe and perhaps willing to fight again another day. Alas, it was not to be. General MacDonald, who was too sick to flee himself, was captured, and most of his men surrendered in the days following the battle. Left behind at Moore's Creek were between 30 to 70 killed, wounded, and captured Tories. Patriot losses were 2, one wounded and one who died of his wounds the following day. More significant than the number of killed and wounded were the numbers of Tories captured later as a result of the battle. Nearly 850 Tories surrendered and were paroled, excluding the officers, on the promise that they would not take up arms against the Patriot cause again. The Tory officers were sent to Halifax and held in the jail until the Provincial Council decided what to do with them. A trove of abandoned and surrendered weapons, wagons, money, and 2 valuable medicine chests were also captured. The decisive defeat of General MacDonald's Tory troops at Moore's Creek Bridge ended any hope of British troops landing in North Carolina for Governor Josiah Martin. British leaders were clear on the expectation. Governor Martin had promised a strong Tory force to carry the load in ending the rebellion in North Carolina, but no such force existed after the engagement at Moore's Creek Bridge. Thus, no British force landed in North Carolina. They instead sailed to Charleston, South Carolina, in a failed attempt to capture that city. Governor Martin's one chance in 1776 to defeat the rebels had evaporated with his army's demise, and nearly 5 years passed before British troops returned to North Carolina in force. Here are the captions of the photographs accompanying the article. The rebuilt bridge at Moore's Creek. Reenactors enjoyed downtime at Moore's Creek National Battlefield. During the battle at Moore's Creek Bridge, Patriots ambushed a force of Loyalist militia mainly made up of Scottish Highlanders who had immigrated to North Carolina. Many of these men carried heavy traditional Scottish broadswords like this one. This sword, circa 1750, is in the museum's collection. Carefully trained reenactors fire a cannon like the one used in 1776 at a weapons demonstration at Moore's Creek National Battlefield. Next, colonial occupations. Have you ever wondered how last names become last names? One common way was through a person's job. It was normal for colonial families to be involved in the same occupation. Jobs were usually handed down from father to son. They became known by that occupation. Some surnames are easy to connect with what their ancestorial occupation might have been, like baker, cook, or weaver. Here are five others. Smith. Smith works with metals such as silver or iron. Tailor, sews clothes. Mason, cuts stone. Thatcher, roofs houses with straw. And miller, grinds wheat into flour. Here's a think about it. Clothing styles change over time, especially over 250 years. The styles you wear to school today are even different from what your parents or grandparents wore. But some things stay the same. We still need to dress for the weather, whether it's hot or cold or rainy. We still wear hats and shoes. Look at the clothing shown on this page and other images throughout this magazine and compare those clothes to what you wear today. How are they similar? What items are the same? How and why do you think they are the same? Which ones are different? How are they different? Why do you think clothing styles change over time? Is it just for fun or to be different? Is it something else going on? Can you think of some specific reasons why clothing changes over time? Next, stories from our collection. Here's a North Carolina $5 bill from 1775. Can you find a building drawn in the lower left corner of this $5 bill? Does it look like a palace to you? The drawing depicts what would have been the grandest building in North Carolina in the 1770s. Governor William Tryon built it in New Bern to serve as a home for the royal governor and his government officers, and it became known as Tryon's Palace. But many North Carolinians, including the backcountry regulators, who felt they were unfairly taxed to pay for the palace, resented the fact that Tryon spent so much money on a fancy building in the eastern part of the state. And also a doll, mid-1700s. Children growing up in the 1700s had toys, but not as many as kids do today. And there were no Nintendo Switches, Squishmallows, or Lego bricks. But there were various kinds of handmade playthings, including wooden carved toys, clay marbles, and of course, dolls. This well-loved doll, which is now missing its hair and part of its clothing, belonged to Anna Caswell, daughter of North Carolina's first governor after independence, Richard Caswell. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.